you see this has characteristically, through the ages, been the attitude of priesthoods, of the guardians of law and order, or as they say in the Episcopal Church, everything should be done decently and in order. The guardians of this kind of thing have always been afraid of the spontaneous manifestations of the Spirit. Not only of things like mysticism, but also of things like falling in love. They are very, very dangerous happenings. And so here is an absolutely astounding paradox comes about. And it goes like this. We know on the one hand that human love is only genuine when it is felt in the depths of the heart. And we know that this is true whether it be the love of man or whether it be the love of God. We are always looking for the genuine article, you see. We don't want someone to love us because they're forcing it. We want them to love us because they really do in their heart. Now, you see, when you go back to the study of the history of the Hebrew religion underlying the history of Christianity, you will find this problem in this way. That you've got two traditions constantly compensating one against the other, playing each other off in the history of the Hebrew religion. The priestly tradition and the prophetic tradition. The priesthood is always concerned with the external observance of the laws. But the prophetic tradition is always concerned with, do you really mean what you do? They constantly condemn as a hypocrite. And you see, in this sense, Jesus is the greatest of the prophets. They constantly condemn as a hypocrite the person who obeys the law without meaning it. Maybe this man does not commit adultery, but the prophet says, if he has looked at a woman to lust after her, he has already committed adultery in his heart. So that if you really obey the law, you obey it with your feelings, and not just outwardly. For as Jeremiah says, the day will come when no man shall any more say to his brother, know God. That is to say, know the law of God. But they shall all know me, for I will write my law in their inward parts. The ideal, in other words, is people who do not simply obey and do the right things, but who want to do the right things, whose desires are transformed. For the heart, to write the law in the heart means to change one's desire. So you see, what this comes to then is a peculiarly paradoxical situation, that you are required by law, to be completely honest. And more than that, you are required by law to be loving, and honestly loving. You must love God and love your neighbor honestly. Not forcing it, not pretending to it, not being a hypocrite. You must really feel it. Now that, you see, is where the astonishing conflict occurs between the mystic and the moralist. For the moralist knows that he has to be more than a legalist. He has to be more than one who insists that the outward observance of the law be kept to. Luther said that the law which requires that inward compliance is the most terrible thing. He based a great deal of his philosophy on an attack on the idea that one's own inner feeling could be commanded. Because, you see, the moment you subscribe to the idea that your inner feeling should be commanded, you let yourself in completely for hypocrisy. If, you see, you tell another person that you love them, because you know you're supposed to love them, and in fact in your heart you don't love them, you're a liar. And therefore, the more you insist on that lie, the more you feel it's your duty to make your feelings over and to love that other person, the more you get yourself deeper and deeper and deeper into trouble. Because here, if anywhere, the truth will out. You will not be able to sustain the pretense. You will not have sufficient energy to go on pretending and making a kind of mock of the feeling of love. And you have at last then, if you're honest, to say, I don't. It doesn't matter whether this is to some other human being or whether in a religious situation, you have to sit back and look at the Lord and say, Lord, I don't love you. I think you're a bore. You're demanding, you're authoritarian, you're domineering. I ought to love you, but I'm sorry I don't. Now, we think, you see, that an honest expression of our feelings would be disruptive of law and order. It wouldn't. Not in the least. Actually, it would be contributive to it. Because if I say to somebody, look, I'm not doing this for you because I love you or because I like you. I'm doing it for you because the book says I must. Now that puts it up to the other person, who has to look within himself and say, honestly, ought I to accept this favor from this person? Or ought I to go about seeing how I could provide myself with these conveniences? He may say, I understand you don't like doing this, but excuse me, I'm in a terrible jam. And I will be most beholden to you if for a little while yet you will go against your feelings and help me out. See, that's a nice way of doing things. That's the kind of real understanding that we have to have. I was associated once with somebody in a business way who was a complicated person who pretended always that he was a great idealist and that he was doing whatever he did for the benefit of mankind, for the furtherance of mutual understanding, for unselfishness and love between human beings. But actually, his dealings were ethically of a very shady character. And I couldn't get on with him because he wouldn't come clean. If he had said, look, I'm in a kind of a jam, and in order to get around this problem, we have to manipulate things thus and so, and I know this isn't very ethical, but that's what we have to do. I would have said, well, I'm entirely in agreement with you. But then he wouldn't have come on with this sort of pious line that was so sickening and offensive. He would have come on in a human way, and we would have understood each other. You see now how real honesty is a genuine basis of morals. Real honesty is always not pretending that your feelings are other than they are. We know, as we deal with situations practically, that we may have to do things that go against our feelings. And it's the same with helping people when you have to, whom you don't like, and you don't want to help, but on the whole, it's rather necessary to do so. But don't ever be dishonest in playing that your feelings are not what they are. Now, from this standpoint, we can perhaps understand something about the deep relationship between morals and mysticism. If we go back, you see, to the experience that I described as mystical, we see that it is the vision, I tried to put it fumblingly in the sense of the rightness, the harmoniousness of everything that you are from one moment to another. That in other words, human behavior, its ups and its downs, is no different in principle from the behavior of the clouds, or of the wind, or of dancing flames in the fireplace. As you watch the pattern of the dancing flames, they never do anything vulgar. Their artistry is always perfect. Ultimately, it is the same with human beings. We are just as much a part of the natural order as flames in the fire or stars in the sky. But this is only apparent to the person who is honest in the sense in which I have spoken. In other words, the person who is tied up with trying to pretend that his feelings are other than what they actually are. He can never see this, and he's always a troublemaker. He is the original hypocrite, the person who is unbelievably destructive, is the person who pretends that he is a model of love and rectitude and justice, and in fact isn't, because nobody really can be. But then superior altogether is what the kind of person I would call the loving cynic, who knows, of course, that everybody has his weakness and his price and so on, but isn't contemptuous for that reason. Incidentally, may I be so bold as to recommend a book, Memories, Dreams and Reflections by C.G. Jung. Jung's autobiography, the life story of a man who, in my opinion, was a superb human being in this particular sense of thoroughly knowing his own limitations and of having a certain humor about them. A man who understood how to integrate into his whole being the devil in himself and the monkey in himself. So then, in the metaphysical sphere, the mystic is the one who feels that everything that happens is in some way harmonious is in some way right, is in some way an integral part of the universe. Now, when we transplant or translate that into the moral sphere, the sphere of human conduct, the equivalent is this. There are no wrong feelings. There may be wrong actions, in the sense of actions contrary to the rules of human communication. But the way you feel towards other people, loving, hating, etc., etc., there aren't any wrong feelings. And so to try and force one's feelings to be other than what they are is absurd. And furthermore, dishonest. But you see, the idea that there are no wrong feelings is an immensely threatening idea to people who are afraid to feel in any case. And this is one of the peculiar problems of our culture, that we are terrified of our feelings, because they take off on their own. And we think that if we give them any scope, and if we don't immediately beat them down, they will lead us into all kinds of chaotic and destructive action. It's so funny that we in our Western culture today say that kind of thing. We who do more chaotic and reckless kind of action than anybody ever did. But if, for a change, we would allow our feelings and look upon their comings and goings as something as beautiful and as natural and necessary as changes in the weather, the going of night and day, and of the four seasons, we would be at peace with ourselves. Because what is problematic for Western man is not so much his struggles with other people and their needs and their problems, as his struggle with his own feelings, with what he will allow himself to feel and what he won't allow himself to feel. He's ashamed to feel really profoundly sad, so much so that he could cry. It is not manly to cry. He is ashamed to loathe somebody, because you are not supposed to hate people. He's ashamed to be so overcome with the beauty of something, whether it be a natural landscape or a member of the opposite sex, that he goes out of his mind with this beauty. Because all that kind of thing is not being in control, old boy. Not kind of having your hand on the wheel. But it is because, you see, we don't go with that, that we are not in control. That we try to pretend that our inner life is different. So I think this is the most releasing thing that anybody can possibly understand. That your inner feeling is never wrong. That's to say, what you feel, it's never wrong that you feel that way. It may not be a right guide to what you should do. In other words, if you feel that you hate someone intensely, it isn't necessarily the right way of dealing with that feeling to go out and cut his throat. But it is right that you should have the feeling of hating, or of being sad, or of what? Frightened, terrified, whatever it is. For you see, when a person comes to himself, he comes to be one with his own feeling. And that is the only way of being in a position to control it. It is in exactly this way that the sailor always keeps the wind in his sails. Whether he wants to sail with the wind or whether he wants to sail against the wind, he always uses the wind. He never denies the wind. Well, and it's exactly that same sense that a person has to keep going with his own feeling. Whether he wants to act as the feeling obviously suggests or act in a different way, he has to keep the feeling with him, because that's his own essential self. But when he attempts simply to sail against the wind, he's lost himself. He's become just a kind of empty mask, which hasn't got any real life behind it. And all its protestations of love and goodwill are hollow. So you see, it is in the most basic, simple situation. A mother has a child. She got it by accident, you know? And she thinks, oh heavens, now I'm all tied up, full of responsibility and so on, I can't stand it. So I really didn't want to have it, and I mustn't think that thought. All good mothers naturally love their babies. And so when she gets the baby, she says, darling, I love you, but her milk is sour. And the baby gets the other message. And the baby's mixed up. And it would be much better if that mother said to the baby, listen, you're a pest and you're a nuisance, and I didn't want to have you around. Well, then they understand each other. And everything's clear. There's no confusion. There's nothing mixed up here. And two, when you feel somebody is a pest and a nuisance, and you really let it go and you tell them so, you're apt in a while to get a sense of a kind of humorous feeling about it. That you can begin from telling them that they're a damn nuisance, and I wish you'd just disappear and get lost. After a while, you say, yeah, you old bastard. You know, and it begins to have a kind of affectionate feeling to it. So, to sum up, what the mystic primarily feels is the divinity, the glory of whatever is. And when we apply that to the moral sphere, what is what one feels genuinely. And this must always be admitted, always allowed. It doesn't mean to say, let me emphasize this, it doesn't mean that we always are therefore compelled to act upon the basis of what we feel. That is to say, to kill the person we hate. Hatred does not necessarily lead to violence. It is unacknowledged hatred that leads to violence. Honest hatred can be expressed in much simpler ways. But the expression, the recognition, the acceptance of what is honestly felt is the moral equivalent of the vision that whatever exists is a manifestation of the divine.
with session 3, The Game of Yes and No.
Now, it has been announced that I would speak this evening about the I Ching. I should just say then briefly that the Book of Changes is thought to be the oldest of the great Chinese classics, and to date from perhaps as early as 1300 BC. Although perhaps the figures of which this classic is a discussion may be much earlier than that, they may go back to the earliest phases of human thought, because the I Ching really is the ground plan of the way in which the Chinese think, and not only the Chinese. It's almost a mapping of the thinking processes of man. And it may surprise you to know that the system of arithmetic, which is used by digital computers, came from the I Ching. We have a binary system of arithmetic in which all numbers may be represented by 0 and 1 in various arrangements. Is you is or is you ain't. So there's a sudden, unexpected link between the most sophisticated mathematical machinery and a book originating at least 1300 BC. But what the I Ching really goes into is this question of, is you is or is you ain't. It sounds terribly simple. Black or white. And we keep saying to people, you know, life isn't just black and white, or black or white. There are many shades of gray. True, but against some backgrounds, gray is dark. In another context, gray is light. And really, all colors, in fact, all information whatsoever, can be translated into terms of yang and yin. For example, when you look at color television, the signals are broadcast to your set as a stream of pulses. They could be put on magnetic tape in terms of an arrangement of pulses indicating either yes or no. This technique has reached such sophistication that with the aid of laser beams, we can translate a physical object. Let's take a complicated one. Let's take a dandelion flower gone to seed, a dandelion clock. You take a dandelion clock about so big, it can be turned into a formula, passed through channels, enlarged to any size, say this big, and with laser beams cut in solid plastic in a matter of moments. So you can get this reproduction of a three-dimensional object. But the transition between the two was handled simply in terms of pulses. So likewise, the nervous system is so constituted that the neuron carrying a message either fires or does not fire. If it fires or if it's activated, that registers as a yes. If it is not fired, the absence of firing is represented as a no. And so you could say that all your perceptions, in all their variety and in all their color, are made up of a vast composite of little yeses
and little nose in every conceivable variation. So out of these two come everything. Yang means the positive, and yin, the negative. Yang is identified with the south or sunny side of a mountain, yin with the north or shady side. And note at this moment that you cannot have a one-sided mountain. Imagine it. And this then is the crucial thing that one must understand about the Yang-Yin philosophy, and it is represented in the symbol of a circle crossed with an S-curve, one side of which is black and the other side is white. And so they're like two fishes. And in the head of the black fish is a white eye, and in the head of the white fish there is a black eye. These two sides are interdependent because the black one is outlined by the white one and the white one is outlined by the black one, and they chase each other in the form which is really the double helix, the pattern of the spiral nebulae, and also the pattern of lovemaking between many, many kinds of creatures. The spiral folding into itself. Black chasing white, and white chasing black. Now, obviously white and black are as different can be. When we say of someone that he's an awful liar and a con man, he say why he could prove to you that black was white. But strangely enough, black is white in a certain sense, and white is black. If you take the copulating word is to mean implies, because black implies white, and white implies black, or positive implies negative, and negative implies positive, because you can't have the one without the other. So to put this into clear words, we can say explicitly black and white are different, but implicitly, that is to say by implication, they are one. So exoterically, outwardly, the positive and the negative of life are very different. Life is different from death, and good is different from evil. But esoterically, the secret is that they are one. As God says through the prophet Isaiah, I am the Lord and there is none else. I form the light and create the darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. But that information is not normally handed out from the pulpit. So we have to begin then seriously considering yang and yin, black and white. First of all, if I have a black background, somehow I am tempted to make a white mark on it. If I have a white background, I am tempted to put a black mark on it. Because if there were nothing to see but black, that would be tantamount to being blind, because there would be no difference. Nothing would matter. Nothing would make a difference. So there wouldn't be anything. Likewise, if everything were white, it would be as good as being blind, for there would be no difference. It is only by contrast, when black and white are put together, that we know black as black and white as white. However, now, when I look at a small white circle or disc on a black background, or a small black disc on a white background, I once get this in my thought. Which is positive and which is negative? Does black represent the negative because it's dark? Like night. But when I look at the black dot on the white background, I think the black dot is the thing there, so that must be positive. It was put on. And therefore the white represents negative because it suggests nothing. No mark, like white paper behind the print. Blank. Blanche. The English blank and the French blanche, which means white, is the same. Blank, negative. Isn't this mysterious, you see, that both white and black can play the negative role? But then let's think of white as light, and it's playing the positive role. And when we think of black as the thing, the mark, then it's playing the positive role. See, both can play the negative and both can play the positive. But still, you can't have one without the other. I look at the black with the white dot, and I say, is that a white glowing sun in the night, or is it a hole through a wall? In which case, the black will be the thing, and the white the absence. I look at the black dot on the white background and say, yes, obviously the black dot is the thing, but on the other hand it may be a picture of a white box with a hole in it. You see, they're reversible. Therefore, some reflections about these. It isn't easy for a human being, the way we've been trained, to notice that you can't have one without the other. Because our attention has difficulty in seeing both sides at once. You know that Gestalt image where you get two faces in profile, and they are drawn as black silhouette. So you get two faces in profile about to kiss. But then look again and you notice the white ground between them, and it is a cup like a chalice. What have we got here? Kissing faces or chalice? People have difficulty in seeing both together. You must have one or the other. Either will do, but make your choice. It's like, are you going to be a boy or a girl? Either will do, but you have to choose one of them. And yet, bodhisattvas are always represented as hermaphrodite, as being, as it were, bisexual, transcending sexual differentiation. Because after all, everybody who exists is the result of a boy and a girl. Boys can't be boys without girls, and girls can't be girls without boys. They are very different. Et vive la différence. But by nature, by reason of their interdependence, they're one. Talking of the bees and the flowers, where there are bees, there must be flowers. And where there are flowers, there must be bees or some sort of insect equivalent. And this implies that the bee and the flower are really one organism. The head of the body looks very different from the feet, just as the bee looks different from the flower. But a complete body requires both head and feet. So the head and the foot are obviously one organism. It's less obvious with the bee and the flower, but they are one organism. What is very difficult for us to see, however, is that solids are all of a piece with spaces. Now here comes the thing, you see. Take a situation in which we say of a given figure-ground relationship that the black is the thing, the black letter on the white page. We say, yes, it's the black letter that's important. That's the thing. But supposing it's a white letter on a black page, still we say the letter's the thing. That's important. All right. So we say we look out in the sky at night and we see the stars and the planets. We say that's what's there. That's the thing. Around them is darkness and nothingness, corresponding to the area of the magnetic tape which isn't magnetized, which delivers no message and therefore the message is zero. But that, you see, does deliver a message. Absence speaks. Nothingness is important. But we are brought up, we are so brainwashed, we are so bamboozled, we are so hypnotized that we don't know that. That's the whole trick that we've played on ourselves. We don't know that nothing is something. And it's important. Lao Tzu put it this way. The usefulness of a vessel is not so much in the clay surround, but in the empty space in which something can be carried. The usefulness of a window is not so much in the frame as in the empty space through which light can be seen. It sounds odd and paradoxical and almost a little contradictory, but nevertheless, there it is. The space is, after all, not nothing. I had an argument with Buckminster Fuller about this, and he had to grant me that I was theoretically correct, because he said, so far as I'm concerned, space is just negative event. Just negative event. The fallacy wasn't in the word negative event, that's a beautiful phrase, it was in the word just, only. As if space could be dismissed. And so in exactly the same way, when we don't recognize that side of life, people can play all kinds of tricks on us. The main trick is, I can scare you with death. You won't be, see? I can remove you. Wowie. You're going to get removed anyway one of these days, and you just won't be. Won't that be awful? That would be just terrible. You know, supposing you won't be, there'll be nobody to realize how terrible it is. But this is the thing, that this is one of the great tricks of life, and you have to be watching for this, as people use it, because they've all been taught to use it. It's really the fall of man, was not to recognize the other side. So everything that we think of as nothing, space, empty space, death, sleep, dissolution, decay, any sort of weakness, anything that goes against structure, that is, against the thing, that we think is bad, 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 and we're trying to get a world where that side of things is rendered impotent. Nothingness must no longer constitute a threat to somethingness. In other words, we want to play black and white, and if we'll call white the light and the positive, white must win. That's the game we're trying to play. Not realizing that there cannot be winning without losing. If white must win, black must lose. But if black loses, we can congratulate black for having helped white to win. Because unless black loses, white won't win. You can translate this into the difficult and thorny question of race relations. How would you know you were free, white, and 21? How could you be proud of being a white man unless you were a black man? You wouldn't know you were living on the right side of the tracks unless there were people living on the left side of the tracks. You know, there's an IQ thing that says up is to down as blank is to left, or left is to blank. You're supposed to fill in, you know. I would put taken. Anyway, taken and left. Right and left. Right and wrong. These opposites get tricky. But the point is, people are afraid of the negative one. Don't be negative. The power of positive thinking. That's all nonsense. The negative is the source of the positive. This is absolutely fundamental to the I Ching. This is why in the hexagrams, which the I Ching is about, 64 combinations of six black and white symbols. Actually, they use an unbroken line for the positive and a broken line for the negative. Six such lines. There are 64 combinations of groups of six, or hexagrams. And in all those, there is not one bad one. There is no sign of the I Ching which you can draw and the oracle tell you this is just plain bad. Because you can get to the very end of the night, the blackest pitch black, and it is precisely at that moment that the yang, the positive element, is reborn. Because you see, it is recognizing that energy is waves, energy is pulsation. Now you can't have a pulse without a vibration. It sounds, if I go, oh, that I'm making a something without a nothing. But actually, if you listen very closely to that sound, you'll hear, you'll hear pulse. Because without that little chunk, which is a pulse, nothing happens. So this table, which is level and solid, and philosophers down there are always talking about tables, because they always have tables in front of them in classrooms. But here it seems solid. But this thing is going at a terrific clip inside it. And wowee, look at that. Analyze. And we find that there are cellular structure in wood. Analyze that, molecules, and we find to our amazement, if you take a molecule out of this table, and it's about the size of my fist, blow it up to that, the next molecule will be, why, way over the other side of the room, at that level of magnification. Say, what's in the molecules? Atoms. Take an atom the size of my fist. Well, the next one be, somewhere in Los Angeles. I mean, you know, I'm just talking fancy shapes and figures. Anyway, a long way away. What's inside the atom? Ooh, the electrons, protons, mesons, etc. And they, at the size of my fist, we don't even know if they're particles or waves, so it's difficult to talk about this, but they are a long, long way from each other. So we suddenly find that in this solid table, there's more space than there is anything solid. I mean, there's a little bit of solid. But as you ferret it out and you go step down, it's like approaching a limit in mathematics. When you have a curve sweeping towards an axis, supposing it's an asymptotic curve, it's always getting nearer and nearer and nearer to that axis, but never actually collides with it. So we get nearer and nearer as we study substance. We get nearer and nearer to finally, what is the shell round the emptiness? We get nearer, we never quite catch it. Solid disappears into space, as at this level of magnification, the space has disappeared into the solid. See, if I just have one finger, or a better illustration, if I take a lighted cigarette in the dark, I've just got one point, but I whiz it around and you see a continuous circle. That's how you see a solid table. Because everything's going zzzz so fast that your eye can't catch the spaces between. Too little, too quick. So, looking at things from one point of view, we find a lot of emptiness. Looking at them from another point of view, we find a lot of solid. But what you have to realize is that the solid is based on the emptiness just as much as the emptiness is based on the solid. So don't be afraid of nothing. It can't bite you. It's only something that can bite you. There's nothing to be afraid of in nothing. And yet, mysteriously, nothing is the source of something. It's like the womb and the seed. So, yang and yin go together. But, through not seeing this, the whole of our life is, as I said, geared to the thought that we might be able to make the yang side win. And so, in every sort of human enterprise, we are trying to have white without black. When you talk about improving the world, you are meaning, presumably, that you want it more white than black. Or whichever one you call the good one. Maybe you think the black is the good. It's all right, it makes the slightest difference. You know, which side are you going to take in the game of chess, the black or the white? Doesn't make much difference, except white gets first move. No, I'll always wait to see what you're going to do. We think, could we get rid of the other one? Now, as you know, in all matters of practical living, it never works. You think now, I've been miserable all this time because I haven't had enough money. I never know whether I make the payments on the car. I never know whether, there's going to be sickness. And if only I had a little more money, I'd really feel great. So you get it. And in the transition from one stage to the other, whoops, you feel very elated. Of course you feel elated, you're going up. $5,000 a year, say. It makes a difference. When you've gone up, then of course you're on a level again. And no longer do you have to worry about making the payments. But you get a new worry. Supposing I get sick and die of it. Supposing someone robs me, takes it away from me, and worry about that. You say, oh, I'd feel so much happier if I had a medical examination. As you go to a fancy doctor, he says, I can't find anything wrong with you. But then always there might be burglars, so you get an alarm system and new locks, and finally you go to the homeless patrol and get a private guard to watch you, and that makes you feel better for a while, except then it begins to nag you. Gee, if I have that homeless patrol man out there, they'll know I've got something. Maybe I better have two men on the job. So, it grows, you worry. Because you found out that you didn't get yang without yin. You got a new yang, a bigger yang, instead of the former little one you had, but you got a big yin with it. It's no joke getting rich. It implies a great deal of responsibility, and you've got more to worry about. Don't envy rich people. It's a great mistake. Don't envy anyone. So, in the same way, Zhuangzi puts it thus, he's Lao Tzu's successor. People who speak of having good government without its correlative misrule, or right without its correlative wrong, do not understand the basic principles of the universe. One might just as well speak of having yang without yin, and such people must be either knaves or fools. Of course, how would we know we were wise unless there were knaves and fools? But here it is, you see. You cannot beat the game. You can have the temporary illusion of winning, but by compensation you will ever so often have the temporary illusion of losing. When you go down a step, from yang to yin, you'll feel, I've lost something. When you go up a step from yin to yang, you'll feel, I've gained something. How would you know gain without loss? How could you have the sensation of more, unless in relation to the sensation less? For sensation is simply awareness of contrast. That's what life is. Now, if we realize that, we get the same feeling of frustration as I wanted to give you this afternoon in trying to make it clear that so far as the improvement of ourselves and of the world is concerned, there's absolutely nothing we can do about it. And this is simply another way of saying the same thing. You cannot have more yang than yin. You cannot play a game which is win and no lose, or a game in which everyone wins. You're stuck with it. Now, in just the same way, if we recognize that, applying yang and yin to all the possible situations of life, we get this awful feeling of, so what's the use? I mean, what do you expect me to do? Jump into the river and drown? Now, wait a minute. Why, at that point, do we get the feeling of, oh, what's the use? Simply because we've found that our favorite game won't work. And we think that is the only thing for which there is any use, is the game in which white must win. But why not change them around? Isn't that a good game? Because it goes whine, 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 like this. Goes in and out. It's the undulation of a wave, the crest and the trough. You can go on every kid likes a roller coaster ride. You go, it's great. So having both is the game. See, it's no game. What we think is the game isn't a game at all. To win all the time, win, 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 that's no game. Because the game is always the hide and seek. Now you see, now you don't. The game is the story in which the villain might win. And the whole idea of drama is to make it seem to the audience that it is the villain absolutely must win. There's no way out, and then suddenly, for whom, a secret thing is revealed and the hero wins. Or if you want a good cry, they have a tragedy and the villain wins. But don't you see? There is no vitality unless there's that negative element. The villain, the devil, the nothing, the death, the out. You've lost. Finish. Bye-bye. Quits. See, if that's not there, then the other one isn't there. And you're always winning. Supposing you know, you sit at home with your wife and you play cribbage. Lots of married couples try to forget holy deadlock by playing games. And if one partner, be it wife or husband, always wins at cribbage, the game ceases to be of interest. Because every good player likes a sprightly opponent who sometimes wins. Wins just a little bit less than me, mind you, but he wins a great deal of the time. Yes, it's okay. He just a little bit. No. So, if you don't have the unknown space, death, darkness, negative, you don't have the light. So the art of life consists rather in something else than trying to make white win. You needn't sit down and weep because somebody tells you you can't make white win all the time, forever and always, so that black doesn't exist. Because black, by its very nature, is darkness and it doesn't exist. You're trying to make it not exist. It's irrelevant. The very fact that it doesn't exist is its power. Non-existence is the necessary condition for existence. Just like you have to have a front before you can have a back. Or a back before you can have a front. They come into being together. So do existence and non-existence. So what are you afraid of in trying to get rid of nothing which is already gotten rid of? So we think, But surely this is rather monotonous. It goes up and down, up and down, up and down, seesaw. Life, death, life, death, life, death. Or birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. Isn't there some way of, must we play this game? It's like the game of one-upmanship. You can't get out of it. You're always playing it. And if you say, I won't play, it means I've got a more interesting game than yours. Which is just the same game all over again. Would there be a way somehow to transcend black and white? So we've got black and we've got white. That makes it even. But isn't there something else? Couldn't there be a tertium quid? A new possibility? So that we could have a three basis instead of a two basis? And somebody comes up and says, all right, you're black and white. A and B, you constitute the two ends of the base of a triangle, and I'm the apex. How about that? We say, that's odd. Of course it's odd, because the first two were even. When something happens, that's one, and that's odd. See, it's odd that anything should have happened. Very odd. It's queer. Would it have been easier for there to be nothing? But then something happened. So then they said, that's odd. Then they recognized there was something and nothing, and then they said, all right, that's right, we're even. So this third fellow comes along and says, now, what about it? And they say, you're odd. Oh, wait a minute. You stand over against us. So that makes two. We're even, and you're odd. All right, so that makes two out of three. Three equals two. Because we're together, we two. We recognize that we're black and white. You can't have one without the other, so we're together. And you say you want to be different, okay? That makes black and white different from whatever you say you are, so we got the new yang and yin. You can't get out of it. Make four, and it's the same all over again. Make five, it's the same all over again. This was how Leibniz reasoned an arithmetic that could represent any number using merely zero and one. See, damn it. Can't we get out of this? hey, what would it be if you were allowed 5 minutes with God, and you're allowed to ask one question? What do you want to know? Because you know, you thought this over now, you know about the opposites, about the yang and the yin. And you know you can't ask God and say, hey, Big Daddy, will you give me a tip to beat the game? It won't work. And what shall I ask God? So you can think of all the things you might ask for. You know, an electric guitar, $1 million. And you know that wouldn't be the answer, because that would be yang. There'd be a big yin along with it somewhere. I mean, I don't know what to ask. So you go in and say, God, beyond positive and negative, what is reality? And God says, my child, your question has no meaning. Oh dear, you thought, there it's gone, my one chance lost. You think, you get a friend of yours and say, hey, look, you go in. And tell me what he says. You ask him, what question should I ask you? He goes in and says, oh God, what question should I ask you? And God says, so you do want a problem. Well, you've got one. You thought it up. You wanted a game in which white only wins. There's your problem. You made it up. You had to have that problem. Because otherwise, if you don't have a problem, you wouldn't know you were here. It's like, you can't be yourself without something you call other. How will you know you are you unless somebody else is somebody else altogether? In other words, the sensation of I here, living, sensitive, alive, peeking out, beady-eyed out of my skin, entirely is it with reference to something over there, which isn't me. I don't know what it is, but it works all by itself, and this, you're pretty scared of it. And there it is. But I can't have this feeling without that feeling. There's the same hocus-pocus going on here. If I can't feel me without having other, that's exoteric. Esoteric means I am the other. They're inseparable. How can you have self without other? How can there be other without self? You other on me and self on yourself. I self on me and other on you. But you can't, as it says, you can't have one without the other. Yang and yin. So in the same way, I say, well, this other, I'd like to manage it. I'd like to control it. You know, I don't want all these people around messing up my life. I don't want them to be that much other. I'm gonna fix you. Then I get on a power kick. And there are all kinds of power kicks, let me warn you. It's not just politics and the economics and business. The worst power kicks are spiritual. Like astrology. You'd like to know the future? Would you really? It's a power kick to know the future so that you can control it. No surprise. If you know the future, it's already past. But if you want to know something and have knowledge, then there must be the unknown. Just as if you want self, you must have other. So the future is always the unknown. The past is the known. And what we witness as our present is the magical appearance of the known from the unknown. You know what's going to happen the next second? I mean, there might be another big earthquake right underneath us. Any minute now. Or the Russians might decide to release the A-bomb. Any minute, you would have a heart attack, drop dead. You don't know what's coming. Well, relax. Then watch this thing happen. It's incredible. Just watch it. You, it, self-other, it's this vibration going on. But you think also now, wait a minute, self and other, that means voluntary versus involuntary. What I do and what happens to me. Now, what do? Well, I walk, I think, I talk, I move my hands. I can be nice to you or nasty to you. I would regard both as my doing. But what about my blood circulation? I normally think that that happens to me. I mean, if my heart would stop, I wouldn't say I'd done it. I would have said that it happened to me. But Buddhists will say, your heart stopped, that was your karma. And karma means nothing else except doing. It's your doing that your heart stopped. You know, that doesn't mean, don't take it literally in a superstitious way, that because you spat in someone's face in a past life, you're having heart failure as a punishment for it this time around. The universe is not geared to be a kind of judicial system. I mean, a lot of priests figure it that way in order to frighten people. But karma means simply, if you die in a plane crash or have a heart attack, it's your doing. But that simply means you've got to rethink what you mean by doing. Now, I've already proved to you that black is white. So now I'm going on to prove to you that what you do is what happens to you. And what happens to you is what you do. Because you can't tell the difference between doing. You can't tell what you mean by doing unless something happens to you to contrast it with, and vice versa. You can't say of something that happens to you unless it feels different from something you do. Now let's take a look at our breath. Are you doing it, or does it happen to you? If you do a breathing exercise, you can feel I'm doing it. Just I'm breathing in just as I might raise my hand. But after a while I breathe out. I feel I'm breathing out. And I forget all about it, and it goes on. And it happens to me. That's why in yoga, which means, yoga means union, joining, same as the Latin jungere. Why in yoga you breathe? Breathing is the main thing in yoga. Because it's to teach you that there's no difference between what you do and what happens to you. You learn that through breathing. You can make the very best breath. See, we get into Christian terms here. The Holy Spirit, spirit means breath, see? Spiritus in Latin, pneuma in Greek, ruach in Hebrew. Breath. Now, there's ordinary breath, when you know, most people's normal breathing. Or forced breath, when people try to sing and their voice is forced. But then, the next breath is called Holy Spirit, holy breath. That's when the breath is no longer forced, it happens. When it's nirvana breath, blow out, same thing as Holy Spirit. And then that, you see, that unforced one. Go on and on. So, that's why when monks chant, or devotees of any kind chant, they have the idea that I am a flute, and the breath, the prana, the spiritus of the divine flows through it. That's what chanting's all about. Make yourself a tube for the divine wind. But that also means realize the unity of the voluntary and the involuntary. That's really what's meant by doing the will of God. Do the will. It's one reason why we get confused in English as to whether we mean will or whether we mean shall. I will drown and no one shall save me. So, think, behind what you call voluntary, you decide. Having reviewed the evidence, I've decided it would be best to buy this brand of detergent. Made a decision. How did you make a decision? Well, I reviewed the evidence, I added up the price, and I came to the conclusion. Yeah, I know all that. But how did you work the machinery? The computer in your head. You know, you pushed all these buttons, but what's underneath the buttons? Oh, I don't know, I never looked. So you see, that involuntary growth called the brain underlies your voluntary decision. Because you, when you decide, you don't first decide to decide. And decide to decide to decide. You just decide. But that means there's something else behind it. Well, you think that's terrible, because if what I do happens to me and it isn't really doing at all, then I'm in a fatalistic scene. Yes, but I said, on the other hand, what happens to you is what you do. It works equally that way. You know, you have an earthquake. And the thoughts in your head drift about like clouds in the sky. But it can't do anything. So in the same way, this whole strain, the futility of the strain to make white win and to improve the world, that entire futility, the frustration of it is what you mean by I. Now it goes. It won't work. And the eye collapses. Everybody is terrified of this happening. Suddenly finding out that you don't have an ego. Heaven preserve me from that, because I've been building up this personality of mine all these years. I've been very carefully nurtured, this personality. You tell me it doesn't exist? No, because your personality is a phantom even more insubstantial than your body. Personality is a work of art. It's like music, which vanishes as soon as it's played.